Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents What is Life? With Mind and Matter and Autobiographical Sketches by Erwin Schrödinger. Foreword by Roger Penrose. Narrated by Bob Sauer. Foreword. When I was a young mathematics student in the early 1950s, I did not read a great deal, but what I did read, at least if I completed the book, was usually by Erwin Schrödinger. I always found his writing to be compelling, and there was an excitement of discovery with the prospect of gaining some genuinely new understanding about this mysterious world in which we live. None of his writings possesses more of this quality than his short classic, What is Life?, which, as I now realize, must surely rank among the most influential of scientific writings in this century. It represents a powerful attempt to comprehend some of the genuine mysteries of life made by a physicist whose own deep insights had done so much to change the way in which we understand what the world is made of. The book's cross-disciplinary sweep was unusual for its time, yet it is written with an endearing, if perhaps disarming, modesty at a level that makes it accessible to non-specialists and to the young who might aspire to be scientists. Indeed, many scientists who have made fundamental contributions in biology, such as J.B.S. Haldane and Francis Crick, have admitted to being strongly influenced by, although not always in complete agreement with, the broad-ranging ideas put forward here by this highly original and profoundly thoughtful physicist. Like so many works that have had a great impact on human thinking, it makes points that, once they are grasped, have a ring of almost self-evident truth, yet they are still blindly ignored by a disconcertingly large proportion of people who should know better. How often do we still hear that quantum effects can have little relevance in the study of biology, or even that we eat food in order to gain energy? This serves to emphasize the continuing relevance that Schrödinger's What is Life has for us today. It is amply worth rereading. Roger Penrose, 8th of August, 1991. Preface. A scientist is supposed to have a complete and thorough knowledge at first hand of some subjects and, therefore, is usually expected not to write on any topic of which he is not a master. This is regarded as a matter of noblesse oblige. For the present purpose, I beg to renounce the noblesse, if any, and to be freed of the ensuing obligation. My excuse is as follows. We have inherited from our forefathers the keen longing for unified, all-embracing knowledge. The very name given to the highest institutions of learning reminds us that from antiquity and throughout many centuries the universal aspect has been the only one to be given full credit. But the spread, both in width and depth, of the multifarious branches of knowledge during the last 100-odd years has confronted us with a queer dilemma. We feel clearly that we are only now beginning to acquire reliable material for welding together the sum total of all that is known into a whole, but on the other hand, it has become next to impossible for a single mind fully to command more than a small specialized portion of it. I can see no other escape from this dilemma, lest our true aim be lost forever, than that some of us should venture to embark on a synthesis of facts and theories, albeit with second-hand and incomplete knowledge of some of them, and at the risk of making fools of ourselves. So much for my apology. The difficulties of language are not negligible. One's native speech is a closely fitting garment, and one never feels quite at ease when it is not immediately available and has to be replaced by another. My thanks are due to Dr. Inkster, Trinity College, Dublin, to Dr. Padraig Brown, St. Patrick's College, Maynooth, and last but not least, to Mr. S.C. Roberts. They were put to great trouble to fit the new garment on me, and to even greater trouble by my occasional reluctance to give up some original fashion of my own. Should some of it have survived the mitigating tendency of my friends, it is to be put at my door, not at theirs. The headlines of the numerous sections were originally intended to be marginal summaries, and the text of every chapter should be read in continuo. Erwin Schrödinger, Dublin, September 1944. Homo liber nulla de re minus quam de morte cogitat, et eius sapientia non mortis sed vitae meditatio est. Spinoza's Ethics, Part 4, Proposition 67. There is nothing over which a free man ponders less than death. His wisdom is to meditate not on death, but on life. Chapter 1. The Classical Physicist's Approach to the Subject. Cogito ergo sum, Descartes. The General Character and the Purpose of the Investigation. This little book arose from a course of public lectures delivered by a theoretical physicist to an audience of about 400, which did not substantially dwindle, though warned at the outset that the subject matter was a difficult one and that the lectures could not be termed popular, even though the physicist's most dreaded weapon, mathematical deduction, would hardly be utilized. The reason for this was not that the subject was simple enough to be explained without mathematics, but rather that it was much too involved to be fully accessible to mathematics. Another feature, which at least induced a semblance of popularity, was the lecturer's intention to make clear the fundamental idea which hovers between biology and physics to both the physicist and the biologist. For actually, in spite of the variety of topics involved, the whole enterprise is intended to convey one idea only, one small comment on a large and important question. In order not to lose our way, it may be useful to outline the plan very briefly in advance. The large and important and very much discussed question is, how can the events in space and time which take place within the spatial boundary of a living organism be accounted for by physics and chemistry? The preliminary answer, which this little book will endeavor to expound and establish, can be summarized as follows. The obvious inability of present-day physics and chemistry to account for such events is no reason at all for doubting that they can be accounted for by those sciences. Statistical physics, the fundamental difference in structure. That would be a very trivial remark if it were meant only to stimulate the hope of achieving in the future what has not been achieved in the past. But the meaning is very much more positive, that is to say, that the inability up to the present moment is amply accounted for. Today, thanks to the ingenious work of biologists, mainly of geneticists, during the last 30 or 40 years, enough is known about the actual material structure of organisms and about their functioning to state that, and to tell precisely why, present-day physics and chemistry could not possibly account for what happens in space and time within a living organism. The arrangements of the atoms in the most vital parts of an organism and the interplay of these arrangements differ in a fundamental way from all those arrangements of atoms which physicists and chemists have hitherto made the object of their experimental and theoretical research. Yet the difference which I have just termed a fundamental is of such a kind that it might easily appear slight to anyone except a physicist who is thoroughly imbued with the knowledge that the laws of physics and chemistry are statistical throughout. For it is in relation to the statistical point of view that the structure of the vital parts of living organisms differs so entirely from that of any piece of matter that we physicists and chemists have ever handled physically in our laboratories or mentally at our writing desks. It is well nigh unthinkable that the laws and regularities thus discovered should happen to apply immediately to the behavior of systems which do not exhibit the structure on which those laws and regularities are based. The non-physicist cannot be expected even to grasp, let alone to appreciate the relevance of, the difference in statistical structure stated in terms so abstract as I have just used. To give the statement life and color, let me anticipate what will be explained in much more detail later, namely that the most essential part of a living cell, the chromosome fiber, may suitably be called an aperiodic crystal. In physics, we have dealt hitherto only with periodic crystals. To a humble physicist's mind, these are very interesting and complicated objects. They constitute one of the most fascinating and complex material structures by which inanimate nature puzzles his wits. Yet compared with the aperiodic crystal, they are rather plain and dull. The difference in structure is of the same kind as that between an ordinary wallpaper in which the same pattern is repeated again and again in regular periodicity, and a masterpiece of embroidery, say a Raphael tapestry, which shows no dull repetition, but an elaborate, coherent, meaningful design traced by the great master. In calling the periodic crystal one of the most
Sample complete. Ready to continue?